You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, waivers are becoming the norm for businesses to protect themselves from financial risk if patrons get COVID-19. A law professor tells us what those waivers mean and what we should know before we sign. First, between history classes and movies, you may have come to know a story Americans tell themselves, that we're a group of people bonded by our belief in common values like equality and freedom. But that wasn't always our story, even if it is now. Our next guest says in the fragile early days of the United States, there was a huge intellectual fight over what that story would be, and it threatened the stability and survival of the country. Colin Woodard is an award-winning author and journalist. He's currently the state and national affairs writer for the Portland Press Herald and the Maine Sunday Telegram. He's written a bunch of books about American history, including his latest, Union, the struggle to forge the story of United States nationhood. Colin, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me again.
You write that no one really knew what this United States thing was in the early days. The one unifying factor was, well, we just kicked the British out. Can you talk about the confusion, though, once that started to fade away?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a previous book I wrote, American Nations, argued that we'd never been one America, but several Americas, because of the differences between the rival colonial projects on the eastern and southern rims of what's now the United States. You know, New England and the Dutch settled area around New York City and the Appalachian backcountry and the Chesapeake Tidewater and the Spanish Southwest never saw eye to eye because they had different ethnographic and religious and cultural and political characteristics. They were each trying to do separate things. And those fissures were deep in our country, and everyone was aware of them. And then suddenly they fought the successful rebellion against British rule, against a shared threat, and they found themselves in a something together, I guess a country, something called the United States. And no one was quite sure precisely what it was, even after a constitution had been created. And so this continued on all the way into the early 19th century. As late as the 1830s, people were still a bit unsure of it. You know, was it supposed to be a loose confederation like today's, you know, European Union of sovereign states? Was it supposed to be an alliance collected together, you know, to share, you know, foreign relations and national defense, but not too much else? Or was it supposed to be a like unified, strong nation state like the Germans were talking about building in Central Europe from all the different principalities and duchies and little empires and kingdoms they had there? And they needed an answer by the 1830s because the revolutionary generation, with their living memories of that sort of shared triumph of the War of Independence, was dying and fading from the scene, and New England had considered seceding during the War of 1812, and Appalachian settlers had considered doing so in the 1790s during the Whiskey Rebellion. It was sort of a national security crisis. So we needed a story as to if the United States was to be a country rather than sort of a alliance. What was its story? Where did it come from? What did we share as values, and where were we going, and how would we define what Americans were?
And you follow that story through the eyes of a bunch of thinkers who wrestled with that question. We'll just be able to meet one or two of them, I think, as we talk. It was messier than this, but a common theme emerges that lasts for a century into 1920 and beyond. One idea that we are united by common vision and values. Another idea that we are an ethnostate of some sort with white people at the top, even if the definition of who white people are changes through time. Can you lay out that tension for us?
Absolutely. In brief, starting in the 1830s, there were those two rival visions you just outlined. One that we were essentially the homeland or homelands of the, you know, allegedly superior Anglo-Saxon race, and that human equality was, you know, false, and that clearly only certain, you know, people from certain backgrounds were capable of self-government and all the things envisioned in the Declaration of Independence. And there was a counter view, what we might call a civic nationalism, that said, you know, we Americans may not share a history because our colonial, you know, groups had very different backgrounds, but we share a future. We share fealty to a set of ideals, those in the Declaration of Independence, about, you know, the innate, you know, equality of humans and their unalienable rights to, you know, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, and self-government. And those things were in tension and fought over throughout the 1830s and 40s and 50s, and then genuinely and literally fought over in the Civil War. And that struggle continued through the course of the book, told through the people who fought it, all the way up to the point where there was, the first nationwide, you know, broad consensus as to which vision they liked. And the rather shocking thing is it's the ethno-state sort of white supremacist vision that first triumphed in the 1910s and 1920s.
We're talking to Colin Woodard about his new book, Union, The Struggle to Forge the Story of United States Nationhood. Let's get to, let's spoil the end of your book a little bit, Colin. I think as I learned history as a kid in school, when it came to black people in particular and civil rights, there was slavery. That was bad. The Civil War ended slavery. There's some Reconstruction, something, something, Martin Luther King. And a lot happened in that something, something period. That was really disastrous for progress, especially for African Americans. Can you talk about that a little?
I mean, absolutely. I mean, in short, one would have thought that that civic national vision that when the Union won the war and won after Abraham Lincoln had, you know, made the Gettysburg Address saying that this is what the war is about. It's about the fact that we have never achieved the ideals we set forth in the Declaration and that this is our chance to do it. And this is the great blood sacrifice of our nation to see if humans can really be self-governing and, you know, live in that kind of equality. And then the Union won the war. And as is often said, the South kind of won the peace in that in the struggle over Reconstruction, the sort of Union occupation and effort to reform and get the South to sort of join the Federation on those grounds, eventually the North sort of gave up and agreed and reconciled with the South on the terms of sort of white reconciliation, that we'll all agree that we all fought with honor, we'll forget about the fact that the war was about these broader moral issues, and we'll have a consensus to allow the country to reconcile and move forward by betraying the promise made to African Americans and allowing the former Confederate states to roll back in a reign of terror by the Ku Klux Klan, African American participation in politics and ability to actually serve in public office. You know, as soon as the Union troops withdrew, that's what happened. And it was an event that would be actually celebrated in textbooks and popular film, including the first great blockbuster movie in the United States, The Birth of a Nation, which was helped along by President Woodrow Wilson, in part because his close friend and fellow Deep Southerner, Thomas Dixon Jr., had written the novel upon which it was based. So these things were all drawn together, and it was not a good moment in period to look back on in United States history and the story of our nationhood.
We're talking to Colin Woodard about his latest book, Union, The Struggle to Forge the Story of United States Nationhood. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What story did you learn growing up about the United States and who we are as a country? What do you see, if anything, uniting people as one common citizen of the United States? Or do you see more differences and divisions than things that unify us? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Colin Woodard about his new book, Union, The Struggle to Forge the Story of United States Nationhood. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think it's important for a country, for our country, to have one unifying idea about who we are as a people? Do you think this country has lived up to ideals like equality and freedom for its citizens? What questions do you have for our guest about this idea of coming up with a national identity? Call in at 800-642-1234. Colin, I want to focus in on one thinker with a very strong Wisconsin connection. And I think I'm guessing a kindred spirit for you based on what he wrote and some of what you've written in the past, Frederick Jackson Turner.
I was hoping you'd ask about him because, yes, Frederick Jackson Turner had an enormous influence on the way Americans thought of themselves. He comes later in my story towards the second half of the 19th and the early 20th century when he was kind of at his peak of his involvement in the story. But he was born in Portage and he attended the University of Wisconsin in Madison and became a professor there and saw things from a Midwestern or what they called then a Western perspective. And it was his belief that what made Americans Americans was essentially the experience of coming into the Midwest and when settlers crossed the Appalachian Mountains and into what he considered this sort of, you know, Eden, that they were no longer contaminated in their experiences by all the baggage of the old world with its, you know, leftover, you know, legacies of feudalism and all of its history, that it may instead could return to be new people. And lo and behold, that experience made them good Democrats and Republicans and Americans, that you would be self-government and creating institutions yourselves and acting in a leveling spirit and being skeptical of aristocracy would all come naturally to the people living on the frontier. And that's what made us who we are. But the rather remarkable thing is, although he articulated this in a famous essay, this frontier thesis, and this thesis would sort of go viral, as it were, and spread almost all over the intellectual landscape and get incorporated into popular culture and later, you know, movies and into textbooks and to the way history of America was taught in universities and elsewhere, he himself quickly discovers, he dove into his research at the Wisconsin State Historical Society and at the archives of Madison and elsewhere, that the actual data didn't support this thesis. That as he looked at it closely, as the different peoples came into what we now consider the Midwest and the West, they didn't assimilate. You know, he was kind of looking at Darwinian principles, that the environment would shape organisms and organisms would adapt to their new environment, and that all these settlers would adapt and become good Midwesterners and therefore Americans. Instead, he found that the different settlement streams, the one coming with its origins in New England and settling the upper tiers, the upper Great Lakes states, and the one coming with its origins in Pennsylvania, settling the upper parts of the lower Great Lakes states, and the one out of Appalachia that was settling the lower tiers of Ohio and Illinois and Indiana and so on, that these settlers had these stubbornly different and distinct political behaviors and ideals that didn't seem to be dissolving in this new environment. And he spent he was a great thinker and a teacher and a researcher, but he was a real procrastinator as a writer. He spent the rest of his life, decades, putting together his magnum opus about the importance of these different sections, which I think was getting at a truism about the country that was missing from the stage. But unfortunately for him, nobody wanted to hear it. He was like a rock star who early in his career has a number one hit single, and then when he goes out later and, you know, tries to go play before concerts, everyone wants to hear his hit song and no one will hear the new stuff. You know, he tried to get attention for it, but people would only give him a polite level of interest. So his frontier thesis, you know, carried on and had a powerful influence for a half century over academia and scholarship and the way ordinary people thought about their country, and in a way still does, even if its author had himself started to feel that it probably wasn't correct at all.
Let's go to our callers now. Greg is on the line in Green Bay. Greg, hello.
Hello, thank you for having me. I have a comment in regards to the question you posed of unity or division in our country. And to the guest point with the propaganda movie from the early 1910s, Birth of a Nation, long before that, and to this day, there are scare tactics used to make sure that unity does not happen. I do not believe that the greed and the power at the top could handle this nation unified in humanity against what they've spent the last 150, 200 years building. And that is a power structure that is able to survive solely on the fact of based on fear.
Greg, I'm going to jump in because we don't have a lot of time left. I want to bring Colin in. Colin, what do you think of what Greg had to say?
I mean, in the early 19th century, when there was this battle between these two rival ideas, this ethno-national definition, this civic national one, the power bases were especially in different regions of the country. There was plenty of cross-regional support, but there was sort of a battle that reflected and echoed the Civil War between the interests of a plantation South and the emphasis that it placed on inequality, which was necessary if you were going to run a society based on, you know, a race-based slave system. You had to deny the things that were said in the Declaration of Independence, and that of the North, which didn't have, you know, if you were to see it cynically in economic or market terms, the North did not have the same incentives as an industrializing place to follow in that thing. So, you know, if what the caller is saying, this hypothesis, were to be true, at least for a long period while it was developing, it would have been at least bifurcated into competing, you know, narratives and structures and stuff between competing powerful people. And, you know, that would be a whole different and interesting discussion to have as to the degree to which that may have affected things. But definitely there was not one monolithic, interest group pushing it, because these two theories of American nationhood were so opposed to one another and incompatible.
Thanks for that call. In our last minute, Colin, this idea of the ethno-state controlling America reached its pinnacle in some ways, as you describe, in about 1920, about 100 years ago. Are we still having this conversation, this debate today in 2020?
I mean, it is. These things go back deep into our history. And, you know, I think people now are wondering what does hold us together as a nation. We have red states and blue, MAGA and Black Lives Matter, fundamental disagreements over values, over who's really American, over monuments and flags and symbols from our past. And, you know, these disagreements have now, right now, spilled out into the streets. So this is absolutely a poignant moment where these things are on the table and being discussed again. And a lot of the tension is between these two heritages. And, it presents our federation, our country, and Americans with an opportunity that we should seize hold of to try to redefine what our shared values are and what holds us together, which, you know, I think is best done with being informed as to what held us together, you know, good and bad in the past, to draw the ingredients to hopefully come up with a meaningful and more satisfying and uniting story that we can all, agree upon to move forward so that the United States, you know, can survive in the longer term.
Colin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
We've been talking to Colin Woodard, award-winning author and journalist. He was with us today to talk about his latest of many books about American history. The new one is called Union: The Struggle to Forge the Story of United States Nationhood. Businesses across Wisconsin are cautiously opening their doors, not knowing how many customers they can expect with COVID-19 still a threat out there. Workers have mixed feelings on reopening, but as Shemaine Mills reports, many workers are desperate for a paycheck.
The coronavirus pandemic put a lot of people out of work. Some are returning, others never left, but many still don't know when and whether the job they had will still be needed. 30-year-old Javonte Woods was a dishwasher at a Madison restaurant before dining in was banned to prevent spread of COVID-19. Takeout means no silverware, plates, or glasses to wash, so Woods was out of work. Meanwhile, across the street, construction never stopped. Heavy trucks are beeping.
The establishments, they had a shortage of customers, so I was laid off.
Woods thought about applying for unemployment, but never did.
I can work now and today, but who knows? I mean, you got new risks and new concerns.
Woods is concerned some customers might not come back, despite the best efforts of business to make them feel safe. Some stores in Madison were preparing to reopen after being shut down several months during the pandemic, but retailers on State Street had a setback. They were vandalized and looted during protests over police violence and racial injustice. On an early morning in June, the city's downtown was quiet, except for some dog walkers and city street crews. Music was being piped out onto State Street from inside a boarded-up restaurant. A few people were on their way to work and glad to be going.
Yeah, I feel really lucky.
That's 22-year-old Erica Hill, a UW-Madison student who landed an internship with the Wisconsin Department of Transportation.
A lot of my friends, their internships with major consulting companies was canceled, so I feel really lucky to work for, this is my second summer working with the Department of Transportation, and I feel really fortunate.
Her major is geological engineering. She'll be working in the agency's technical department to determine locations that can support traffic. If the internship hadn't come through, he'll dread it a long summer with nothing to do and no income.
I have no idea. Maybe look for a job at a restaurant or a grocery store, just anything for money. You know, like I'm a student. I need to pay all my loans, so...
She's not worried about working around others during a pandemic. Hill said she'll wear a mask and keep her distance. She won't be inside the office more than she needs to. Others aren't returning to work. They never left. Like 34-year-old Tom Neal, a registered nurse at a Madison hospital.
I'm just thankful to be able to work. I feel much worse for people who work in service industry, restaurants, you know, non-essential jobs, quote unquote, that have gotten furloughed. A lot of nurses I know who work in critical care have been furloughed as well because they don't have the patients for the hospital to support their salaries.
Neal isn't concerned about catching COVID-19 at work because testing is rigorous and there are precautions to prevent its spread. But he worries about others who are in close contact with the public day in, day out.
People that are busting their butts, you know, bagging groceries for a quarter of what I make at my job that is guaranteed, are taking all the risk all day long. If I'm going to get it from somebody, I'm going to get it from a coworker, not from a patient right now. They are all tested to the nines.
Health officials say testing can help start a stalled economy by allowing them to control the virus before it gets a grip on a community. And businesses are trying to do their part by cleaning more and preventing crowded conditions. Because no one wants to close again, a decision that could depend on whether there's a second wave of a disease the world is still struggling to understand. Shemaine Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up, a lot of businesses and other organizations are asking customers to sign waivers, COVID-19 waivers, in order to use their services. Think gyms or haircuts or even political campaign rallies. What do those waivers mean? Should you sign them? We'll talk to a law professor about your options and what these waivers mean in an actual legal sense. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show, the head of a Wisconsin group that advocates for police officers talks about the George Floyd killing, nationwide protests, and how departments and individual officers are responding. That's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, we're pretty used to the idea of a waiver. We generally have to sign them when we're setting up to do something dangerous, like jump out of a plane or use any kind of computer software. But with states attempting to open back up amid the ongoing pandemic, waivers are showing up in more and more places, like gyms, hair salons, the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, and political rallies. For example, for people wanting to attend President Trump's campaign event scheduled in Oklahoma this weekend, here's a little bit of what they have to sign. Quote, by clicking register below, you are acknowledging that an inherent risk of exposure to COVID-19 exists in any public place where people are present. By attending the rally, you and any guest voluntarily assume all risks related to exposure to COVID-19 and agree not to hold Donald J. Trump for President, Inc., BOK Center, ASM Global, or any of their affiliates, directors, officers, employees, agents, contractors, or volunteers liable for any illness or injury. So, what legal power do these waivers have, and should we sign them? Elizabeth Tippett is associate professor at the University of Oregon School of Law, where she focuses on employment law, behavioral ethics, and decision making. Her recent piece for The Conversation looks at the rise of COVID-19 waivers. Elizabeth, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, we saw one prominent example of that campaign rally waiver. Are we really seeing a lot of these things showing up in our daily lives out there?
I've seen them in my daily life. Our local YMCA requires you to sign a waiver. When I took my daughter to the dentist, there was another waiver. My friend who got a haircut had to sign a waiver. I'm definitely seeing more of them. And when I talked to the CEO of a company called Smart Waiver, she said she's seen a lot of demand from these companies that don't usually ask for waivers.
What is some of the standard language we see in these things for those kind of day-to-day things, the haircut or the dentist appointment?
Well, not all of the language is bad. So some of the language I actually thought was kind of helpful. It would say, you know, you need to wear a mask, or it would say, we want you to know that we're taking social distancing seriously. But it would also contain language saying, you assume the risk of death or injury from a COVID-19 infection, and that you waive all claims against the business that you'll be visiting.
Should we sign those? I guess it's, do we have a choice to sign those if we need, I don't know, a dental treatment, for example?
You don't really have a choice. And some of these waivers are online where you can't really cross things out on paper, even if you were bold enough to cross something out on paper. I mean, your real choice is, are you going to go through with your appointment or not? And if you're dealing with an essential service, you may not really have a choice.
And you make the case in the piece you wrote on The Conversation that these aren't necessarily bad unless if a company's whole approach to COVID-19 remediation and prevention is a waiver that says it's not their fault if somebody gets sick, that worries you, I think.
Yeah, I think the way that businesses should be handling this problem is one of shared risk, because I think in reality, that's what COVID-19 is shared risk. If you're a customer, you are exposed to risk when you go to the business, but you're also a risk for the workers at the business. And so I think it makes sense for these contracts to say, you agree to take these precautions, we agree to take these precautions, and maybe it's okay to have a waiver if both sides are already agreeing to do their part to minimize the health risk.
We're talking to Elizabeth Tippett, associate professor at the University of Oregon School of Law, talking about COVID-19 waivers, a lot of businesses requiring their customers to sign off on these. Let's talk about the enforceability of waivers like this, Elizabeth. If I go to a business, I sign their waiver, but I get sick, I somehow know I caught COVID-19 there. Are they protected even if they've been negligent in the way they handle their health and hygiene?
Well, what I've heard a lot of lawyers say is it's too early to say, because we're so early in this pandemic, there isn't case law where judges are ruling on the enforceability of these waivers. I would expect there to be state-level variation. Some states are really waiver-friendly, and they have the attitude that if you sign it, it's binding, and that's part of your freedom as an American, is your freedom to sign away your rights. Other states are more cautious and protective and will look at the circumstances and whether it was take it or leave it and whether it's bad for the public for these waivers to be enforceable. So I expect there to be, you know, an it depends kind of answer.
As a parent, I've signed waivers for activities for my kids or myself, you know, along the lines of if you go into this bouncy house, you may die and it's not our fault. with that kind of I'm paraphrasing, but with that kind of precedent out there, like is that enforceable? Does it vary from state to state? Does it matter if the bouncy house manager in this case did a good job or was really negligent?
Okay, if the bouncy house manager was grossly negligent or intentionally harmed your child in the operation of the bouncy house, in those situations, a lot of courts will decline to enforce that. But if it's just ordinary negligence, like they're doing what all other bouncy house operators ought to do to make it safe-ish to be in a bouncy house, then that's, you know, a lot of cases it's enforceable.
Now that's an activity where you could see the risk of injury. Do we have any examples where people have waivers specifically for the risk of transmission of a disease? We haven't had a spreading disease like COVID-19 in a good long time, I feel like.
Yeah, I think the analogies are to other areas of law. So, for example, in prisons where people have been infected with diseases in prison, you know, that's not a great analogy and they can't really sign a waiver. Or situations where people get infected at work and they file workers' comp claims. That's another situation where infectious disease sometimes comes up. But this is kind of a new territory of like waivers in the age of pandemic.
Now, here's another example. I don't know, maybe this is stretching it, but say I go to the whatever and I sign the waiver. I catch COVID-19. I know it's from them. I can't sue them because of the waiver. But somebody catches it from me. Can they go? They didn't sign a waiver. If they can trace the chain of transmission to a business, could they potentially sue them because they're waiver free?
Oh, that's a great question. I think tort law also hasn't really sorted out what our duties are to each other in a pandemic. And I think it will depend on, you know, were they at your house? How negligent were you in your interactions with them? But certainly it is possible that you could be sued for, you know, being reckless about the way you're transmitting the disease to other people. That's definitely possible.
And that's one that we'd have to see how it shook out in the courts. I don't think you're predicting or advising people on the legality there, I'm guessing.
It's way too early to say. But one thing I would say is I think as this goes along, we'll have a better sense of what's reasonable behavior. Because tort law is so much about reasonableness. And right now, everything's kind of up in the air. And I think 6 months from now, I think we'll have a better sense of what's reasonable and unreasonable in your daily life and in your interaction with businesses and in the way businesses treat you.
We're talking to law professor Elizabeth Tippett from the University of Oregon about waivers people are having to sign so they can't sue a business or organization if they catch the coronavirus while in their space or using their service. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Now, have you encountered one of these waivers already? Have you had to sign something somewhere to say, yeah, I don't hold you liable if I catch COVID-19 at your business? Or does your place of work require the customer to sign something like that? Would you attend a campaign event like President Trump's where you'd have to sign a waiver like the one in Oklahoma this weekend? Or is it something you're not really worried about? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about COVID-19 waivers that many businesses and others are requiring their customers to sign. Elizabeth Tippett is with us from the University of Oregon School of Law. You could join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234. Have you signed a waiver in order to get some kind of service or access to a business? Have you required your own customers to sign a waiver of some sort? Do you have a question with how these work, what their legal meaning actually is? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Elizabeth, I want to branch this out a little bit to employees. We've seen some workplaces like meatpacking plants in the Midwest and elsewhere where we've seen outbreaks of COVID-19. And I know you look at employment law, among other things. Do workers have recourse if they feel, if they can make a case that a company was negligent in offering protections?
Yeah. So in employment law, your recourse would be to file a workers' comp claim. And to win in a workers' comp claim, it's not about whether your employer was negligent. It was about just showing that you were infected at work and not through some other source. And so I think when you're talking about first responders, like nurses or doctors, and some states have said that we'll presume that you contracted it at work. For other types of work that it may be harder to prove, although with contract tracing, it may be easier and easier to say, I can prove that I got this disease at work.
Are there equivalents of waivers in workplace situations that might say you can't make this kind of claim in the event of transmission of disease at our worksite?
Not really, because it's pretty clear that you're supposed to file a workers' comp claim, and that's not really waivable ahead of time. So it's less of a concern in the workplace, I would say.
Now, with the waivers, getting back to now the consumer side of things, are companies that issue waivers necessarily thinking they're going to have to waive these waivers around in a courtroom, or are these kind of preventative? Hey, people have signed the waiver, they're less likely to sue in the first place.
I think it's both. I think insurance companies really like these waivers because it deters people from filing claims. And also it reduces the amount that you'd settle for, because most of these cases get settled and the insurance company will say, hey, you don't have a claim, you signed this waiver, and so we're going to settle with you for a lot less money. I think that's a lot of what's going on.
Now, we had a caller who couldn't stay on the line. Getting back to on the job here, they wondered, what if their employer says they need to sign a COVID waiver? Does the employee have to sign it even if they don't think the company is following the rules? The caller said at their work there's no masks or sterilization happening. They've been open through the entire pandemic. So if your boss says, hey, sign this COVID-19 waiver, which you say it doesn't sound like a lot of people are doing, what do you do then?
Well, if you're worried about safety, I would call the state workplace health and safety office, like the equivalent of OSHA for your state. Or if you don't have a state workplace health and safety office, you can call OSHA, which is a federal agency, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. I would do that. And if your company retaliates you against making that complaint, then you might have a lawsuit available to you. One option might be to refuse to sign the waiver, but it's a little early to say whether courts are going to say that, you know, if you get fired for refusing to sign a waiver, that you have a lawsuit. So here again, it's really uncertain, and I think workers are in a pretty bad spot.
We're talking to Elizabeth Tippett from the University of Oregon Law School, looking at COVID-19 waivers that a lot of businesses and other organizations are having people sign to do business with them. Let's bring on a caller now. Aaron is with us in Wisconsin Rapids. Aaron, hello.
Hello, how you doing?
Good. What'd you want to bring up, Aaron?
Well, you know, I just wanted to go ahead and comment that, you know, I'm self-employed, and having a waiver is almost essential until the general public step up and take responsibility for their own lives, for their own actions. You know, everybody wants to go ahead and have the freedom to, go out, possibly not wear masks when they go to public locations. And then it's essential that somebody have a waiver for them to sign, because everybody these days is so happy. And of course, nobody, especially a small business owner, wants to get sued for something that's really out of their control.
Aaron, thanks a lot for that call. Elizabeth, Aaron saying, hey, if you're a small business owner, you got to protect yourself with something like a waiver.
Yeah, I mean, you can hear the fear in his voice about the situation right now, because imagine if a customer comes in and infects other customers, not wearing a mask, infects their workers. So, you know, they would not only be worried about a lawsuit from the customer, but a workers' comp claim from the worker, or a lawsuit from the other customers. I mean, I think everyone is in a difficult position right now. And I do think, as the caller said, we need to take shared responsibility, and the customers need to do their part to reduce transmission as well.
Thanks a lot for that call, Aaron. And let's talk about that shared responsibility concept a little bit. That kind of goes beyond the law and legal side. It gets into, I guess, kind of our ethics as people who share a community.
Well, it's also actually kind of a legal question, because you can accomplish that through contract. You could say to your customers, you've signed a contract ahead of time, including in the waiver, that you agree to take these following measures: abide by our social distancing rules, you agree to wear a mask, you agree not to come in if you're sick. That to me seems entirely reasonable.
Elizabeth, as we wrap up just in our last minute, what are you watching for as this waiver story goes on?
I'm just watching to see how the courts are going to react, and whether there's going to be a lot of pushback from consumers when it comes to signing these waivers, and also whether Congress is going to just pass a blanket immunity that makes these waivers irrelevant, because they might do that.
Elizabeth, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Elizabeth Tippett, associate professor at the University of Oregon Law School. We talked to her today about COVID-19 waivers. They're getting more and more common these days. You might encounter them as you go to seek a haircut, a dentist appointment, you name it. You can keep sharing your thoughts, by the way, over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let us know if you've seen them and what you think of this idea of COVID-19 waivers. Hundreds of thousands of people in Wisconsin are out of work because of the coronavirus pandemic. With no money coming in, many find themselves visiting food pantries for the first time. WPR's Danielle Kading reports that food banks and pantries across Wisconsin are making changes to help meet demand as the nation has witnessed disruptions in the food supply chain.
Vicki Graff is stopping in at the Bayfield Food Pantry for the first time.
I always felt like people who needed it even more than me, but they keep encouraging me to come.
Graff was working for the local chamber, but they reduced staff due to the pandemic. She hasn't heard whether her job will be brought back and is pursuing other options.
It hasn't been really, really bad, you know, with the stimulus money and unemployment. It's been manageable.
Mary Doherty, who helps run the food pantry, says more than 400 people visited the rural food shelf for the first time in April alone. She says the COVID-19 crisis has transformed their operations.
The food pantry normally operated was like a grocery store where people would come in and pick what they want off the shelves. But we can't do that with social distancing.
Now people pull up in their cars outside the food pantry and volunteers decked out in gloves and masks run food out to them.
We'll open up the trunk and we put it in the car just to stay distant.
That's volunteer Lisa Lutnan of Washburn.
And then we sanitize our hands between each car that we put items in.
The pandemic has changed more than how they run. It's also changed what food they're getting and how they store it. Doherty says they've received bulk quantities they're not equipped to handle. So she's worked with community partners to store food, including Danny Simpson. He's assistant manager of a food center at Northland College in Ashland. Simpson says they've stored food for Bayfield's pantry and repackaged donations from local businesses that were forced to shut down for Ashland's food shelf.
Restaurants, because of their volume and the amount of food that they're kicking out, don't receive those smaller, nice packaged quantities.
Food banks are also grappling with changes in the supply chain. Shane Morris, executive director of Second Harvest Northern Lakes Food Bank, says food from area grocers declined after people rushed to stock up on food in March.
So we began purchasing product. So we will go out to, you know, major manufacturers nationally and, you know, secure a truckload of something or multiple products. But that comes at a higher cost for us.
In 2 months, Morris says they bought more than $350,000 worth of food while demand has grown. More than 17,000 people visited the food shelves they serve in March, closing in on levels not seen since the Great Recession. Wisconsin's food share program that provides money to families for buying food has also seen a spike in people seeking assistance. Food share director Rebecca McAtee says they saw more than 15,000 applications filed in 1 week when demand reached its peak. But those numbers have come down as unemployment payments have started to come through.
Generally, if the economy is kind of picking back up and opening back up, you know, that might also have an impact on whether people are continuing to apply.
Judy Bartfeld says the number of people who are uncertain where their next meal is coming from or lack access to food is likely beyond anything seen in recent history. She's a food security research and policy specialist with the Division of Extension at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Bartfeld says helping people recover will require work on multiple fronts.
So it's not just about strengthening our food pantries. It's about strengthening our public food safety net. It's about strengthening our income safety net. It's about being able to get people back to work. There's so many levels at which we have to tackle this if we want to really think about long-term progress.
As of this month, more Wisconsin households will now be eligible to receive emergency food assistance from food pantries after state and federal officials signed off on a proposal to raise the income limit. Vicki Graff, who was visiting Bayfield's pantry for the first time, thinks food shelves are going to be even more important as time goes on, especially if the nation sees another wave of coronavirus cases this fall. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You can follow more reporting on the impact of COVID-19 here in Wisconsin over at WPR.org/news and at wiscontext.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, as protests continue around the country, our guests say they reflect a wider long-term trend of growing distrust in many of our major civic institutions here in the United States. We'll round up some of the top stories in national politics, the latest from Congress, the White House, and a big setback in efforts to negotiate with North Korea. Plus, professional sports are figuring out how to play ball again, but things might look a little different when they get back into action. We'll find out how professional baseball and basketball leagues are planning to swing back into action. You can let us know what you think, what you want to see major leagues, basketball, baseball, football, and beyond, what you want to see from them, how they should get back into games, and when and if you think crowds should be part of the picture. Let us know what you think. Email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us @CentralTimeWPR. All that and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.